Now then, you are very welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Coming to you in two parts today. Johnny Murphy is here with me to look back at the Investec Champions Cup, look ahead to this weekend's BKT United Rugby Championship games, and we'll also talk about a fairly busy week of contracts, transfers, comings and goings across Irish rugby. Later on in the podcast, Ali Miller is going to join me to look back on Ireland's dominant win over Wales in the Guinness Women's Six Nations last Saturday, and look ahead at that big task coming ahead of them this week when they travel to England. But Johnny, let's start with an actual game of rugby before we get into Jordy Barrett and the Tyler Blaindell stuff and everything else that's going on, Peter O'Mahony's new contract. Because there was actually rugby last weekend. There was a fairly busy, fairly big rugby game last Saturday in particular. And it's funny, like with everything that's gone on, it feels like about 2-3 weeks since Leinster beat La Rochelle at the Aviva Stadium last Saturday. Not quite payback for the two finals they were beaten in 2022 and 2023, but a pretty emphatic job nonetheless.
Yeah, look, I think it was, you know, I think everyone was at halftime, you know, just when La Rochelle got that try just before halftime, everyone is like, oh no, not again, because Leinster were in complete control. They didn't control kind of their exit, you know, their last kind of, you know, say 2-3 minutes, La Rochelle score to go in, and you're like, oh my God, even though they've been on top, the, you know, the momentum is with La Rochelle. And then it just completely changed for the second half. It was an incredible performance. There's a lot in it in terms of probably the external factors of the travel. How did that affect, you know, La Rochelle? But then you look at how, what a defensive performance and what a physical defensive performance they had. And you look at Tadhg Furlong's tackle, that kind of sums up the microcosm that was the D on Will Skelton, where he picked him up and drove him back and he landed on his back. And you're like, right, that kind of set the tone for everything. But yeah, their defensive efforts, their work within their blitz to, you know, to stop the amount of passes that were coming on board. And you hear all the, you know, the pundits saying that Jacques said that it was going to be 14 weeks till, you know, he got it right, and to the day this is 14 weeks. You know, it's kind of just lent itself with everything going up to the build up, you know, with what was said in the press conference, you know, all the stuff you were thinking, Rog is a genius, you know, going to Cork, training in Cork Con, everything in the build up, Leo's comments before around, you know, it's kind of, you know, it would be great if there was people, you know, supporting us from an Irish perspective, all that. And you're kind of, and then, as I said, the try before halftime, you're like, oh God, what's going to happen now? But, you know, they stuck to script, stuck to process, and, you know, they dismantled a very, very good, you know, La Rochelle team.
Yeah, and it's funny, like you mentioned the stuff Leo Collins said but the day before the match, because I'd say all week leading up to the match, I had a decent feeling Leinster were going to win. I thought it was the travel that actually was going to catch up with La Rochelle, and they were missing some front, you know, they were missing Red Awardy and Pierre Bergeret and Georges-Henri Colombe, and but then on Friday, after that press conference, there was just this nagging feeling that, geez, La Rochelle still, I think all of us thought, anyway, La Rochelle still have Leinster a little bit rattled, and Leo Cullen definitely seemed a little bit put off by the La Rochelle love-in that had been going on down in Cork for the few days before. And then you get there at the Aviva Stadium on Saturday afternoon a few hours beforehand, and you find that Hugo Keenan's hip still isn't right. He's going to be pulling out, and Kieran Frawley is going to be in. All of a sudden, you're starting to think, geez, things are starting to stack up against Leinster here. But in fairness, Kieran Frawley goes in and does an absolutely fine job at fullback. And in fairness now, it's something we probably have spoken about across Irish rugby in the last 2 years. What happens if Hugo Keenan goes down injured? We've seen it at three times across these last couple of months, both for Leinster and Ireland. And whether it's been Frawley going in or Jordan Larmour going in for Ireland against Scotland in the Six Nations, the sky hasn't fallen down.
Yeah, massively. And I think it's credit to what they've built. you know, the strength and depth that they have in those positions, and it shows that people can, you know, look, any team that's missing Hugo Keenan in the world is going to be, you know, every team who has Hugo Keenan is going to be a better side. But, you know, the performances and the levels of the guys coming in are not dropping off. And, you know, Keenan is world class. So, you know, they've big boots to fill, but they've filled them very, very well. Whoever has slotted into those positions. You know, Jordan Larmour is back to, you know, form. You know, he's flying.
Jordy Barrett can slot in there next season as well. Yeah. We'll get to that later.
Like, it's just, you know, their strength and depth across every position is second to none from a Leinster perspective. I think that just shows the strides that particularly, as you said, with the build up and everything, you know, losing someone early, even though they probably would have known that potentially on Thursday, but they kept it quiet, you know, or certainly there would have been a doubt. So Frawley would have been getting a load of reps throughout the week. So, but it was just a seamless interchange. There was that level of pre-game anxiety, and then at halftime, you know, your WhatsApp groups kick on and you're like, you know, the first one is, oh, Keenan's out, oh, what? And then they score, and then it's, you know, all the analysis over the 10-15 minutes of halftime, oh, they're back in the game. But they just, you know, they just steamrolled them in the second half.
Yeah, and like the halftime part is the other big element of it, as you said, where Leinster had been going well. They'd scored shortly before halftime to make it a 17-point game. And funnily enough, you're thinking it was 17 points early on in the Champions Cup final last year as well. La Rochelle scored a try just before halftime to make it a 10-point match heading towards halftime. All of a sudden, you're starting to think, oh no, here they come again. It's like a movie villain or something like that. Some kind of baddie in a horror movie or something. You know, you can't get rid of him, like the Terminator or something. And then all of a sudden they come out, start of the second half. Ryan Baird scores that great try down the touchline. And I think just as important was a few minutes later, La Rochelle, can't remember the exact circumstances of how they got back down into Leinster territory, but they pinned Leinster back. Leinster had a line out 5 metres from their own line there or thereabouts. And you're thinking, okay, this is, you know, Leinster and Ireland and a lot of the Irish provinces have had some lineup problems over the last few months, particularly in the shaky areas like this. And Dan Sheehan fires an absolute bullet to the tail where Jason Jenkins goes up, catches it contested. And I just distinctly remember at the Aviva on Saturday, like that was that cheer at that lineout was greeted as if Leinster had not necessarily scored a try, but, like, you know, won a vital penalty down at the other end of the pitch. It was a massive moment. And I think just the way they handled those first 10 minutes of the second half probably summed up the difference between this year and last year and the year before.
Yeah, and they, you know, they, all those doubts, you know, regardless of what people say, you know, are going to be in the back of their minds. They don't get an opportunity to play straight off when they go in at halftime. And then the ability to execute at such a high level, like that was a perfect dart, perfect movement in the line out at full stretch. It was, you know, line out under pressure, probably perfection. And, you know, that under those circumstances and those pressure moments against that team that they have such history with and such rivalry with in this competition, it was immense. And to a squad, they really, really stood up. You know, I think their preparation during the week, you know, chatting to a few people, was really, really high level, and they just really put on a performance. But, you know, we talk about their attack all the time and what Gibson Park does, you know, those little scoots down the blind side, what Ryan Baird does, you know, in open field, you know, a little added extra that they had this was their attacking kicking game, particularly when they pulled out the back of that shape in the middle of the park, be it a two or three man, and then kicking a kind of half cross field into those spaces. You know, so they're layering all the time on their attack, but you look at what their defense did. And, you know, people are bringing up the Jack Nienaber stat of, you know, kind of passes per phase, you know, and they have a certain amount of passes that they want to shut down off off an edge from a 15-meter ruck if they come back down blind, from a 15-meter ruck going to width, from a midfield ruck going back to going open, you know, going to width as well. And they just shut it down. And like you can bring in all these systems and you can do all of that, but physically you have to be on the edge and be able to put in those shots against, you know, a massive side. And they just had that intent and they just did it. It was the defensive sets that they put in were incredible, particularly in the second half.
Yeah, and you're talking minute 1 to 80 on that defensive stuff as well. Like, I think the one of the other clips that probably sums up the entire match was into the last 5 minutes, La Rochelle in possession in the Leinster half, ball bobbles, Caelan Dorris fly hacks it, and there's probably, by the time the ball is picked up in the La Rochelle 22 by whichever La Rochelle player it was covering a full back at the time, there's three or four Leinster players on him in an instant. And you're talking, this is 76, 77 minutes gone when it's a 27-point match and the game has been over for 15 minutes. And you can see they still have the appetite to defend absolutely relentlessly as if the game is still in the balance.
Yeah, and like their pursuit of that, you know, people don't like kind of the word ruthless around different things, but they were ruthless in what they did. And they never stopped. And I think that's what they've been looking for. They've been looking for that statement win against a side like that, that pushes them forward. But it's only quarterfinal stage. They've got two big games to come in that, you know, to come in that competition. You know, first things first, they've a huge game in Croke Park against an excellent Northampton side. And they're going to need that. They're going to need that ruthless edge when it comes to defending, you know, a Sam Vestey attack system. You know, Sam played with him in Leicester for 5 years. You know, he's a genius in terms of how he has them playing their first phase moves. So they're going to need that edge to them when it comes to, you know, the semi-final. But yeah, it was a very, very impressive performance.
Moving on to Monday evening then, and apologies to non-Leinster fans, there's just a lot of Leinster news this week, so they probably are going to be dominating this section of the podcast. But talk about a bull from the blue, Jordy Barrett, arriving in December on essentially a half-season contract from the Hurricanes, turned down offers from Japan. He's going to spend his sabbatical from the New Zealand Rugby Union over here in Ireland. There's probably two elements to talk about with this. First of all, it's the on-field, like, just what a signing Jordy Barrett is, and also there is, I suppose, a bit of a backlash from other provinces that the idea of the rich getting richer in Irish rugby. First of all, just focusing on the on-field stuff, what a bloody signing.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, you're looking at, you know, what Rocky Elsom did, what Brad Thorne did in those sabbatical times, what they brought to the whole organization, as a, you know, what to the organization, not just for those 6 months, but what they put in place over, you know, go back to Rocky, you know, like a lot of people would say they wouldn't have won in 2009 without someone like Rocky Elsom. You know, Brad Thorne had the same influence, probably more, even a bigger influence off field in terms of what he brought into that. And it's an incredible signing, particularly for the period during the Six Nations when they're going to be down a lot of players. You look at the back line that they could potentially be able to field. What is someone like Sam Prendergast going to get playing with Jordy Barrett outside him at 12 for 3 or 4 games? What's he going to learn from him over 6 months, you know, that he's there? What is the like of Jamie Osborne going to learn? Any of those younger back three, those back three players, or any, you know, young academy guy that's going to be training with him day in, day out, that, you know, he is going to leave a huge amount of, it's not like, you know, they're signing someone that's at, you know, the early stage of their career, and they've 10 or 15 caps. Like, they're signing genuine, proper world class. And I think their intent with, you know, Leinster, in terms of their coaching signings, with getting someone like Jack Nienbaar to replace Stuart Lancaster, signing someone like RJ Snyman early in the season, you know, the conversations around, you know, the Thongan tour, whether he's going to sign or not, you know, what they have gone out to do is they've analyzed what they've probably missed over the last kind of 2 or 3 years to get another European Cup underneath their belts. And they've gone, right, this is what we need. This is what we're going to get. And I think that just shows, you know, for someone like Jordy Barrett, from a financial perspective, you know, he could have gone to Japan and got paid 2 or 3 times more what he'd be getting here. You know, that's just the level of what the Japan League has and the opportunity, you know, financially that has for players, but the opportunity to win a Heineken Cup still holds a lot. And I think off field, you look at what they've done signings wise, and they can speak to any player in the world and go, oh, right, okay, you're doing this. That's what fits, and that's what makes it such an attractive place for any world-class rugby player to come to. But I think from an organization perspective, what he's going to bring to all of those young guys, and he can play every game during the Six Nations. You know, like, that's massive. He can lead for those 8 weeks when there's however many Leinster players gone into Irish camp that they don't see for those 8 weeks. And, you know, he'll play, if he's fit, he'll play all of those games. He'll bring so many younger guys on, you know, even the 2 week period, people forget around the IRFU rules, you know, the 2 week period or the 3 week period where the Irish, you know, the Irish century contracted guys have to, you know, have to be rested.
Around the Christmas, New Year games and things
Christmas,
like that.
Christmas, New Year games. Yeah. Playing all of those. Mm-hmm.
You have any, just to go back, like you mentioned some of the younger players and what they'll get from it. Would you have any concern about, like, in the last 6 months, we've talked about Jamie Osborne as someone who should now be getting a look in with Ireland over the next 12 months. Would you have any concern about someone like Jordy Barrett coming in and taking his place for, even though it's only 6 months, but taking his place for the business end of next season?
No, I don't think so, because it's going to be a fair fight. And Jamie, if he wants to play for Ireland, he needs to be competing with, you know, selection-wise, he needs to be competing with the likes of Bundiaki, who's also world-class. He needs to be in that frame. You look at Jamie, if he continues his trajectory, he'll be in, hopefully for him, he'd go on the tour, but he'll be in, you know, certainly you'd be thinking by then he'd be in the Autumn Series squad for Ireland. But then if he doesn't get picked, you know, he can come back and play outside, you know, Jordy at 12. If Jordy Barrett's at 12, he's at 13. You know, I think it's a massive opportunity. It's a 6 month stint where he can sit down beside him. He can have a coffee with him. He can get his book out. He can learn so much. And he needs to be a sponge. All of those younger guys need to be sponges with someone like that. And I think that's the opportunity that these younger guys need to see. That's what it is. Okay, yes, I'm going to be, when it comes to semi-final, quarter-final, semi-finals, finals, I'm going to be competing with him, but use him to try and get ahead of him. And, you know, like, I think that is the opportunity for every single one of those younger players.
The other side of this transfer then that has probably gained a lot of traction in the few days, like, this was announced a few hours after it was confirmed Dan Sheehan is moving on to a central contract in the summer. You go back to December, Caelan Doris was announced onto a central contract, and the following day the RJ Snyman news was confirmed by Leinster. You don't have to be a genius to join the dots and see that players moving up to central contracts is freeing money for World Cup finalists to come into Leinster next season. There's talk that Jameson Gibson-Park is probably going to be moving up to a central contract in the next couple of months as well. So potentially next season, you'll have 10 Leinster players on IRFU deals with Tadhg Byrne, Bundee Aki and Ian Henderson, one of each from Munster, Connacht and Ulster, the only other three centrally contracted players. Are we moving towards a situation in Ireland now where the Leinster's quality is breeding inequality around the other three provinces? And while they're obviously doing their own thing and doing very, very well, and I don't think you could argue against any of those 10 players deserving central contracts, but is the system now got to a point where it is creating inequality around the four provinces?
I don't know. There's so much in it, to be honest, Neil. Like, look, over the last 2 or 3 years, they have been the best team in Ireland. Okay, you know, they didn't win silverware last year. Munster were the only province to win silverware last year. But, you know, the best team, they have the best players. From a centrally contracted perspective, that's where the majority of the central contracts are going to go. They represent the majority of players in an Irish squad. That's the way sport works. Yeah. There's probably a greater argument that is probably economics based around all sorts of things, be it, you know, the opportunity from a population perspective that Leinster have, the private school competition. There's more schools playing because there's greater population. And that's a wider conversation, but that conversation is not within the boundaries of sport. That's a population and a country socioeconomic conversation. And you look at, you know, the dubs in football, you know, people are calling it financial doping, but they have the biggest population. So, you know, what can you do? It is something that, like, you can't say that it's not creating inequality, but that's the way it works because they're the best team. They have the opportunity to probably get more external funding. They're not necessarily crippled by any financial debt from a stadium perspective. You know, if you want to go into this, you can go the whole way back to Munster being the biggest brand in world rugby in the early 2000s. You know, they built a stadium, economic crash. Oh, you know, how's your luck? Then they have to redo to try and build a center that took a lot longer than they would have hoped. It's a conversation that is so, you know, to really analyze it, it's so broad, but the reality is, and when you look at the cold hard facts, you know, Leinster are the best team in Ireland. That's the reality. They contribute the most to the Irish team from a playing perspective. So there are going to be more centrally contracted players to them. So yeah.
Could there be an olive branch extended to the other provinces, for example, where if you are in a situation where the centrally contracts are weighed so heavily towards one province that maybe the restrictions on signing foreign players are loosened a little bit for other sides? Is that an option? Because I kind of would agree with you that it's very, very hard to look at the central contracts and say, you know, all four provinces have to be given an equal number of central contracts, because that ultimately is, that's just, you know, it's just not right. It kind of, the entire system has to ultimately be based on merit, but it's very, very tough to find a middle ground in all of that, obviously.
Yeah. And then you see, you have to look at, say, for instance, say centers in Munster in terms of, if you're going to do that, you know, historically Munster have always had foreign centers. When do you go, okay, well, you know, we have to try and breed homegrown centers of an international standard that are going to be pushing? And, you know, so it's such a balancing act to get right. But, you know, those decisions are, you know, they're for, For now they're for David Humphreys to resolve. And this is something that he, I think he's taking over on his own over the next couple of weeks. That's, he has to get down to the nitty gritty and try and figure that out. But professional sport is is ultimately, it's money led. It's revenue generating. It's, you look at what's happened in England, with teams going, going bust, teams that have been around for decades that have won European Cups that are now no longer in situ. And that's because of the financial constraints of professional sport. So, yeah, but then, there are some really good things being done in the other provinces. Munster, for instance, at academy level, they've changed, they have, Ian Costello's come back, Gareth Prendergast is the, academy manager there. They're really pushing forward. There's some really good, and I know from coaching myself, there's some incredible, 18, 19 year olds, 17, 18, 19 year olds in the system in Munster, but that's going to take 4 or 5 years for them to hopefully be wearing red jerseys consistently week in, week out, to then hopefully be pushing and being wearing green jerseys that then allows them push the central contracts. And, there's an opportunity in Ulster now with Richie Murphy going up there to give them a 3, 4, 5 year opportunity to get a young, relatively young coaching group, and potentially bring coaches like the likes of Willie Falloon in, who's done incredible things at AIL level, academy level, and Irish under 20s level, to go, right, guys, there you go. Let's push on. You look at what, Connacht, how they play. Okay, they're lacking for consistency around that. What Mark Sexton and that younger coaching group, how they started the season, the elements that they show in terms of their attacking strategy, what they're trying to do. That, that again will take time to bring fruit to, but Leinster have been at the top of the game for a long time now, so they're at not a crest of a wave, but they're at the top in club rugby in the world, and that allows them go into the market and get guys like RJ Snyman, like Jordy Barrett, because of the quality that they've shown over the last decade, nearly.
Final Leinster point, and we can use it as our segue to head off to Munster then. Tyler Blaindell was the latest recruit coming in as Andrew Goodman's kind of replacement in the summer as officially assistant coach, but you would assume it's attack/backs coach at Leinster next season. Obviously someone who you overlapped with briefly at Munster as well, and interestingly has worked under Jack Nienaber at Munster as well, but someone who had to retire quite young, only 29, I would say, maybe just gone 30 when he officially had to retire, that persistent neck injury. But someone who we always would have heard was pretty much destined to go straight into the tracksuit and grab a whistle and become a coach. I remember it was when he was in his final injury layoff just before COVID, with Munster. His neck was gone again, and Munster were playing in the Champions Cup over at Saracens, and I was over at that match working, and I distinctly remember he was out that day and did it for a few other games as well, like being part of the coaching team running the warm-up that afternoon when he was out injured. And, he was still officially on the playing roster as an out half at the time. You were saying it as well, that he's someone you kind of instantly just would have, everyone knew he was going to be going straight into coaching once the playing days were over.
Yeah, like when the minute he arrived, he'd say something in, first couple of weeks in a meeting, and you go, right, he gets it. Even though he was, 22, 23, came in with a big reputation after World Cup, Axel signed him, and he was just one of those stereotypical kind of Crusaders guys that could talk rugby forever. You know, a great view on the game, a very kind of laid back type of character, in the sense that wouldn't get fazed by a whole lot, regardless of pressure of, and, you know, I think, you know, his performance in that Glasgow game after Axel's passing kind of shows what kind of fortitude that he had from a mental pressure perspective. He would have been always one of the guys that, you know, I would have said that just got it. It was like when you have a conversation over coffee with him about rugby, it was like talking to someone that had played for the All Blacks for 50 or 60 times. It was like sitting down with the likes of Aaron Major or any of these guys from the Crusaders that just, you know, and historically like Darrell Gibson, Aaron Major, all these guys that have just produced these incredible coaches over, you know, years and years and years. And, you know, I think when you join the dots, obviously the work that he would have put in with Jack and Rassi while he was there, obviously there would have been a connection there regardless. With, I'm sure they would have kept in contact over a while, or, you know, someone like Jack Nienbaar would have been monitoring his coaching pathway and what he's done with the Hurricanes. You know, I think they're 6 from 6 and they've scored the most points from
an
attack.
7 now as well.
7 from 7, yeah. So they, you know, he's a very high level coach that is at probably an early stage of his coaching journey. And, you know, it's bringing back a partnership that worked together for a number of years in Munster. So, I think it's a great signing.
Yeah, Leinster's recent strike rate when it comes to coaches would make you believe that it'll probably work out. At worst, it'll probably do okay. But anyway, yeah, we'll move this on towards Munster, because heading towards a really, really crucial part of the season for them now. They're taking on the Bulls this Saturday, first of two games in South Africa. Bulls this weekend, third place Bulls. Lions then away the following week. Then they've got Connacht at home, Edinburgh away, and Ulster at home to finish out the URC regular season. Not the easiest run-in, Johnny, by any stretch of the imagination. Even the, you know, you're talking two games away in South Africa, two Interpros, and Edinburgh away, which is by far a gimme. But Munster have given themselves a little bit of a buffer between themselves and the rest of the playoff teams. Like, they're up to fourth at the moment. I think it's 8 points ahead of Ulster / Edinburgh in the eighth, ninth spot. So there's a little bit of a buffer there. But when you factor in, obviously, the strength of schedule they have between now and the end of the season, there isn't a huge amount of wiggle room for them to slip up.
No, and look, I think this is the time last year that they turned their season around. They'd be drawing a lot from that. And hopefully, you know, the sickness that was in the camp for Northampton is good to go. You know, these five games are, you know, I think this block of games, this 2 week block, for every province is huge. It's going to decide, you know, home quarterfinals, I think, and also a lot going to go to that top eight. You know, there's 11 teams probably pushing for that, including the Lions. You know, so you look at what, you know, they obviously have Bulls and the Lions. Lions, I think, are in 11, but they still have, you know, they're in that.
They're well in touch, yeah. They're well in.
They're 34 points, like there's 4 or 5 teams on that. So, yeah, this is, these 2 weeks are going to be huge out there. But, you know, they did it last year. And I think if they get, you know, 2 wins away, they probably can hopefully solidify their, you know, home quarterfinal slot. And more importantly, the top eight. But, you know, I think they're looking for, you know, that home knockout stage game, really, in the position that they're in at the moment. And they can wholly, you know, just concentrate on this, on these two blocks. They know they're out there for 2 weeks. They come back, have a bit of time off, and then they get back into it. So it's, you know, get out, get the job done over the next 2 weeks, and then move on. But, you know, this is going to be a big game this weekend.
Bulls, you'd imagine, are going to be fairly well stacked after resting all of their.
Yeah, well, look, you know, that's
obviously should be well rested as well, having had the weekend off. And I think crucially as well, over the next few weeks, it looks like they're probably going to have Ollie Yeager is probably going to be back as well. He traveled over, I saw pictures of him training. So starting to get a few bodies together at the right moments. The Peter O'Mahony contract stuff is, I'd say it must be a massive relief to a lot of people in there that even if he didn't sign, that just a decision has been made now and everyone can kind of just move on. Because I don't know, I feel like that has probably just been hanging over them for a few months, just trying to get all that stuff ironed out.
Yeah, it's a difficult time this year in terms of, you know, if you're not signed up, you know, kind of pre-Six Nations, then you go into Six Nations and then, you know, you're up and down and then you're out and you're looking to try and get into knockout rugby and that's hanging over your head. You're going home and questions are being asked, is this or what? You know, it's always nice to try and get it done early. The fact that it's dragged on and it's been in the public space as well hasn't helped anyone. But you know, I think that's, and you know, you hear, you know, even from his, you know, from the press release, you know, he is fully committed to both teams, Ireland and Munster, and just wants to put performances that keep him in those spaces and in those selection conversations. So that's going to be huge. It'll give everyone a lift. And yeah, but this is the time, this is their time. You know, last year they turned it around. I've no doubt that they're going to go out and you know, have two really good weeks. You know, touring can be great fun. You know, it's different to being at home. And you can really, really enjoy that time if you get going. Someone like Simon Zeebo is in unbelievable form at the moment. Yeah, I think it sets up. I'd fancy them to do a job this weekend. And as difficult as it's going to be against a really good Bulls side, but this is a huge game, and it's what Munster is built upon.
Yeah, like you think. Coming out of these next two games with 5 points and going home is probably a solid result to build on for the rest of the season. We'll move on to Connacht though, because I thought it was interesting a couple of minutes ago. You said like this block of two games for pretty much everyone is really, really important. Connacht summed that up brilliantly as well, because they've been in this on-off form. We thought they turned a corner against Pau in the Challenge Cup, and then just were so frustrating last weekend against Benetton, where every time they did something good, it just felt like they followed it up with something bad as well. But like we talked about Munster's strength of schedule going in, and it's quite difficult. Connacht is a little bit either way, where Zebra and Dragons these next 2 weeks, the two bottom teams in the division, win those two games at a minimum, and ideally with bonus points, and they're putting themselves in a great spot ahead of a really, really difficult run in against Munster Stormers and Leinster away to finish these off. Ultimately, Johnny, they have to win these two games to stand a chance, really.
Yeah, I think, look, if they can get 10 points in the next 2 weeks, they have a really good chance. You know, we spoke about earlier about, you know, people saying that the other Irish provinces don't support each other. Well, Connacht will be supporting Leinster this weekend, Munster next weekend. Because if Leinster and Munster can beat the Lions, that's a huge help to Connacht in terms of the table. But 10 points and results go their way around them, then they've a really, really good chance of qualifying for knockout stages and ultimately European Cup, which is where they want to be, Champions Cup. So, but yeah, it has to be at a minimum, as I say, it has to be two wins, but 10 points and they're in the mixer with the other fixtures that are going on around them.
Yeah, and even like you're trying to map ahead to what potentially is happening for future games. And you know, Leinster away on the final day, Leinster obviously notoriously difficult trip to be making. There's a possibility, well, there's a strong possibility Leinster will have sewn up first place in the table long before that final game and could probably be resting a lot of players ahead of the quarterfinal the following week. So there's so much kind of jigging around and trying to predict things. Like we were on Connacht's call yesterday with Pete Wilkins, and I asked him, do you have you five games left, have you a number in mind as to the number of wins you need? And he said, well, I do, yeah, but I'm not going to actually say what it is, because so much can change over these next few weeks. That's exactly the way it goes, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's you know, they'll just be looking at other results around them and all that. You can plan all you want, but Yeah, look, I think, as we said, it's huge in terms of for them. This block is a good block for them if they get good results.
Yeah. So starting with Zebra this Saturday evening, Ulster then to finish it off on the URC. Similar to Connacht, we thought they were turning around a corner last week with that win in Montpellier, but it's one step forward, two steps back. 53-14 against Clermont at the weekend, wilted in the heat in France. And then, like, just to make things worse, you have this Stuart McCluskey and Stephen Ferris going at it with each other on Twitter, and it's just the mood up there just does not seem to be right. But as we talk about the fixtures with other teams, they've got Cardiff at home this weekend, Benetton at home the following week, Scarlett's away, then Leinster at home, which would potentially be the week before a Champions Cup final, maybe if Leinster are there, and then finish off with Munster. There's, for as difficult form as they're in at the moment, it's entirely possible they finish out this run with four wins out of five and comfortably make the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that's huge. Like, they're playing Cardiff this weekend. Now, to be fair to Cardiff
gave Munster a hell of a game a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, and you know, the Leinster game that they played you know, during the Six Nations, they were probably in that, the scoreboard didn't necessarily affect where they were at. They play good rugby, and they've been unlucky in terms of the results. Not unlucky, but you know, they are under pressure to, like, they're, I think, on 24, I think. So they're struggling a bit from results perspective in 12th, but they're not, their performances have been better than results have shown. Ulster have the luxury of being at home this weekend. They need a bounce back after last week. As you say, the difficulty in terms of the mood up there, you know, something like that's happened with, you know, Fez and Stuart McCluskey, it doesn't look great. It's, you know, it just creates conversation around, okay, well, what's going on? He's obviously struck a nerve in what he's trying to do. But, you know, again, there was a bounce back, obviously, when, you know, Richie went in and things have changed. It'll be another week under what Richie wants them to do, how he wants them
to play. And also as well, sorry to interrupt, like a first home game for him as well. Because he's been four games on the road now. Like, what, as critical as you can be of that performance against Clermont, that was a two-game tour in South Africa straight off the back of the Six Nations, followed by a trip to the south of France to play Montpellier, come home for a couple of days, and you go back to France again to take on Clermont. It has been a fairly arduous 4 weeks for them.
Yeah,
100%. And now they have a nice little run of home games coming up.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, look, they can get a win this weekend if they got, you know, but they have to shore up their defence. You know, like, they were in the game with Clermont, you know, and then just in the second half, they just got blitzed, their defence, they were passive, you know, they're mauled D. So there is stuff to be working on. When they have ball in hand, they, you know, they do play, and Richie's team he'll continue to develop that attacking process. If they get a win this weekend, then, you know, the Benetton game is huge at home. You know, but they need to put in a performance, galvanize themselves as a unit, they forget all the external factors, and just go out and perform, hopefully have a big crowd in Ravenhill, you know, and get a good atmosphere then there, and get a win, and then move on. And as you say, of all the run-ins, this 2 week home block for them is a good block. And if they get a victory this weekend, then the Benetton game next week will be massive for them. You know,
eighth place at the moment with five games to go. But to be totally honest, looking at the fixtures and the way the small difference in points between pretty much 11th and fifth place, you wouldn't be surprised if they were knocking up around fifth by the end of the campaign. So I'm going there this Friday evening. Looking forward to it. I haven't been up there since just before Christmas, and would be good to see how the Richie Murphy revolution is going. There's a doubleheader of URC on RT2 and RT Player this Saturday afternoon. The Lions against Leinster and the Bulls against Munster, back-to-back. Bulls-Munster is first up, I should say. That's coverage starting Saturday from 1:30 on RT2 and RT Player. Johnny, thanks a million. We've got through a hell of a lot of ground today between all the games and the the comings and goings at Leinster as well. We'll chat to you very soon. And for those listening, stay tuned. We will be talking to Alison Miller about the Guinness Women's Six Nations very, very shortly. Now, you're very welcome back to part two of this week's podcast. We are shifting our attention towards the Guinness Women's Six Nations, where Ireland finally got off the mark in the championship last weekend. A 36-5 win against Wales down in Cork, getting off the mark in some style and ending their run of 10 defeats in a row. Alison Miller, former Ireland international, is here to talk to me about that and about this weekend's game away to England as well. And Alison, we were just saying before we hit the record button, probably thought Ireland were going to win just about. We didn't expect them to win by that margin or by that emphatically.
Yeah, and look, I think it shows great mental resolve for that team to come back from that Italy result and get a win and get such a comprehensive result. Because I thought I'd watched some of Wales and England. I thought actually Wales had some good, really good passages to play against England and scored two tries. A lot of teams don't do. But Ireland were really, really good. And I think then Wales didn't. I was down at the game and I never felt, there was no sense that I felt like they were ever going to really cut Ireland open or score. There was never a sense of that, especially when you're down there and you're getting a feel for the game. They just, I felt like they weren't offering a whole lot. So, no, look, credit to Ireland for not letting them do that. But look, yeah, great game for Ireland to get. To get the confidence up and rectify the errors they had from the Italy game, their handling was a lot better. Their breakdown was a lot better. Decision making, they were more direct. They carried ball when they needed to, and they were very lateral against Italy. So, it's good to see, because it'd be very easy to kind of sit back in themselves out of that Italy game, and you know, which they have probably done in the past. And but they showed what kind of rugby they can play, and it was very positive.
Yeah, it was. And there's a couple of bits to it as well, where you mentioned coming in off the back of that Italy game. And what was going to be really, really, really important last weekend was they needed a result, not just to kind of end a losing streak, but really as a response to what happened against Italy, where when you look back at it now with the benefit of hindsight, like Ireland probably should have won that game by 15, 20 points. Like they were so in control of it and kind of handed Italy the win. But there was the question last week of what was that 2 week gap going to do for Ireland? Was it going to give them time to work on the things that went wrong against Italy and iron out those issues? Or were they going to stew on the defeat? And was it going to linger then leading into Wales? And we obviously got the answer emphatically at the weekend. The other part of it then as well was how they start the second half. And it's similar to what I was just talking to Johnny Murphy about Leinster and La Rochelle, where Ireland went into halftime. They'd been completely in control, 21-0. And there's just a little bit of you wondering, are they going to allow their 15 minutes to maybe just play on their minds a little bit and lose the momentum that they had throughout that first half? I was probably thinking about it more than you, who were at the game, because as you said, like with the benefit of, you know, when you were at the match, there was no real sense that Wales were coming back into it.
Yeah.
At the time when I was watching it live, I was half watching it at the Aviva Stadium before before the Ireland and or before the Leinster and La Rochelle game kicked off. So, you know, straight after halftime, they come out, Katie Corrigan scores, puts the game to bed, and that's it.
Yeah, just go back to your first point about them having the 2 weeks off. It probably beneficial in a way, because yes, there is the contracted girls that are full-time, but there's the girls that are working and the girls that are in England. So look, they probably got to come in and spend a little bit more time together, which, you know, for the women's team is really important. They're not always collectively together. So that was obviously massive opportunity for them to try and get things right and iron out a few issues. And then Katie Corrigan just, you know, put to dead any kind of a Wales comeback. You know, if you're Wales and you're trying to get in after halftime, you're trying to chase the game, and then to like concede a try from a block down is just demoralising. And like, credit to Katie Corrigan, she has scored two tries in the Six Nations that she's made all of her own. You know, an intercept try and a block down try, so credit to her. She's a young player, but she seems to have that kind of poacher's ability to make something happen and, you know, get the ball and get over the line. And that just, I think it knocked any bit of fight that Wales might have had. We didn't see it, but it did knock it out of them. So, yeah, what a great way to start the second half and just go from there.
We spoke obviously about Clean and Maloney last week and the how important it probably was for the game in general that she was back in the Irish setup. Strictly from a rugby point of view, though, we probably saw it at the weekend where she came on after 52 minutes. And I would say prior to last weekend, there was no way in hell Niamh Jones was coming off the pitch after 52 minutes in any Ireland game. It's just like instantly the level of depth Ireland have is just massively increased. And you're not necessarily worried if Niamh Jones is going to be coming off after 52 minutes. Because I would say if that had happened against France over in Le Mans, you probably would have been very, very worried.
Yeah, and another point is it's probably the best that I've seen Niamh in sense of her throwing, you know?
Yeah.
Suddenly, I think she was a lot better today than she had been. Like, as I've said, it's probably the one thing that probably lets her down a little bit as a player. And that can be the case with some hookers. But she was nailing them, you know, generally, you know, obviously one or two missed. But that, to me, shows just suddenly, you know, you've cleaned them up, Loney, on the bench and, you know, you've got to perform. So we get a really improved performance in that sense from Niamh Jones. She's obviously very reliable around the park. So that's the pressure there. That's the competition. And it's not saying that, you know, Niamh Jones before Cliona was there was ever, you know, conscious of that. But then Cliona Maloney comes on. She's a physical player. And she had the game that she needed. You know, I'm sure she felt a little bit of pressure having been out of the game for so long. And all, like, she just needed to get out there and concentrate and just have a nice, solid game, which she did. And I think her confidence will grow and she'll get better as she gets another two games into her, because she's been out for a little while. She's obviously been playing really well at club, but it's great to see her get back on and, you know, wear an Irish jersey, which I'm sure she thought she'd never see again for a long time.
Staying on a couple of individual players, and I think we've spoken about her after every game now, but Aoife Wafer, she's the real deal.
She's the find of the season for Ireland, and she's such an aggressive ball carrier. You're looking at her and it's not like sometimes, you know, you think the tackler has her, they've tackled, they've good technique, and she just leg drives so aggressively out of
leg,
it.
The leg drive is incredibly impressive.
The
body position when she's going into contact, the small little things like that, that she's very much a rugby player rather than an athlete.
Yeah, I think she has a bit of speed about her, but yeah, I think it's that leg drive sets her apart and the directness that she runs at. And, you know, she runs kind of rides the contact, she gets through it, and I think that's a massive thing to have. And during the game, my husband turns to me and he goes, she's no regard for her body, like in a great way as a rugby player. She's just all go. But she's got the skills to back it up too, you know. She gave a lovely pass for Bavin Parsons try. He just held it, you know, drew in the defender. She's got good skills as well. But she is, you know, she's definitely the find of the season. And she's definitely up for a player of the tournament. Definitely, she's has to be in contention for that. So it's great to see a player like that come on with such confidence and just the aggressiveness of her carries, the determination. And, you know, some people die in the contact. She comes alive in the contact, because sometimes you think she's going to be a rook here and we're going to have another phase. But no, she's made a break through it. And that's really hard for a defence, because they probably structurally are doing the right thing, you know, Wales, but then she's just gone. So, I mean, you know, you can't plan for that, really. You can't plan. It's hard to plan for that.
Yeah, I think she'd be well in the mix for player of the tournament, as you said, when it does come around. I'm almost certain she's been nominated for player of the round 3 weeks in a row now. You mentioned Bavin Parsons there as well, and herself and Katie Corrigan. It's something you've brought up a couple of times now during the Six Nations, where you kind of want to see them getting involved a bit more, and not necessarily just Ireland getting the ball to them, but them finding a way to get on the ball. Was there any evidence against Wales that there's a bit more creativity in trying to get those players in possession?
Yeah, definitely. Like, Parsons was definitely coming off a win, which was great to see. You know, it's the first time I've seen her, you know, track and play, and she was over on the right wing sometimes or midfield. And then, you know, because you just have to have the license to do that as a player. Maybe someone just needs to say to you, you know, sometimes you do need. I remember when I first started playing, someone said to me, you know, you just go, like, go in Rome, and you go, okay, they're backing me to do this, I'll do this. So maybe there was a conversation had there, I don't know. But what it does is, if you're not getting the ball up very much as a winger, you're not beating players, you're not getting that confidence, you know, and the more you start beating players, the more confidence. So if it does come to you on your wing, you're not having been starved for 20 minutes, not touch the ball, which can get in on you, you know, and it's that kind of mindset. Okay, I've beaten her, and you grow into it. So that was great to see, because, as I said, like, she was up against Jasmine Joyce, who's a very good defender, who's equally as fast as her. So it was important for her to get off her wing and to get involved and get those carries. And then the try came, then, you know, out in her wing, but she got a lot of carries and contacts in the game before that, which, you know, is how you grow into a game for any player. So great to see. That would be the next, like, Bavin Parsons is obviously a lot more experienced than Katie Corrigan. Katie Corrigan will start developing that as she goes. She's really young, and that will take time as well. And she can learn from Bavin Parsons there, you know, experienced winger that she is now, Bavin. So Katie can learn from her. And that's good, because you need someone to be able to learn from as well, and watch, maybe, and watching games and watching training, how they approach it. So great to see.
Looking ahead then, England this Saturday at Twickenham, about as tough a task as you could possibly get in world sport at the moment, I would arguably say. Selection-wise this weekend, looks like Linda Jungang and Aoife Wafer are going to be fit. They both picked up knocks at the weekend, but what we heard from Scott Beaman yesterday was that they were training and are looking pretty much okay to be available. Team will be named tomorrow. Would you envisage any changes from the 15 on Saturday, or is that about as good a team that Ireland would go with again?
I probably think that's probably as good as a team that, yeah, possibly won, maybe. But I thought, like, Idel McMahon had a great game and just kind of proved that she should always be in that starting 15. You know, she stole some ball at lineouts, turnover ball. She carried really well. So it was great to see her back. I think that will be the starting team. Maybe I'll be surprised, maybe one selection, but I think that's the 15 good to go, and they've had great confidence from the Wales game. So look, they're looking to carry that through. And, you know, England is a huge test, and they haven't really probably got out of third gear this year, England. And
which is a scary prospect as well.
Yeah, like, they could easily field two teams in the Six Nations. And, yeah, you know, and that's the thing. They've had different players come in and out. They can do that, you know. Like, it's probably... Would I really know England's best team? No. But Ireland just have to go in there and, you know, they'll take confidence from their attack and try and limit England's attack. And, you know, we saw, I think it was 2021, Ireland lost them 25-0, and it was probably the lowest attacking score that England had that whole tournament. So Ireland will look to try and do that and challenge themselves against the best, because they are the best, and it's the old age, they have nothing to lose, as you know. So go out there with that and, you know, try and rattle them, have a go. You know, their confidence should be up, and they have their defence. You know, we said from the France game, their defence had improved. So, you know, they're going to try and put that into place and really frustrate England. And as I said, it'll be hard to know what selection they go with. They're probably trying to give players time as well, which they can do it any week against any opposition. So, but I think you got to go out there with the mindset and try and match and beat your individual player and get excited about that. You know, you got to have the excitement. I'm playing the best team here. I'm going to be better than, you know, my opposite number. I'm going to be much better. That's what you have to do.
Yeah, playing in front of close to 50,000 people, which I'm sure for almost all of the players on that pitch, maybe there's a couple in the Premiership who would have been involved in big doubleheaders over the last few years, but for the vast, vast majority of those players, they haven't come anywhere near playing in front of 50,000 people at a stadium like Twickenham. As tough as we're expecting this weekend to be, it's an enormous stepping stone for them. It's an enormous learning curve and an opportunity for them to experience something that'll stand to them 2-3 years down the line. And I suppose, similar to the opening game against France, while it's not great that we have a tournament where you have to treat matches like this, you kind of just have to pick out certain elements of the game, I suppose, and certain targets that you want to be meeting, whether it's, you know, hitting a certain tackle completion percentage, or, you know, getting your set piece right. And as Scott Beaman used the phrase, firing some shots.
Exactly, yeah.
I think, like, if Ireland come away from this weekend and, you know, if it isn't an enormous scoreline and they have, as they say, fired a couple of shots like they did against France, a tangible result for Ireland this weekend is having something to build on ahead of that game against Scotland in a week's time.
Yeah, and that's the key. You know, it's going to be an exciting last game for, you know, try and get that third spot. And if Ireland, you know, the big hope is they come out with a good bill of health after the England game, because obviously England are so physical. But, like, at the same time, we talk about, you know, France and England being so far ahead. But credit, we don't probably give enough credit to those unions for pushing the game on. And, you know, if they hadn't done what they had did all those years ago, we wouldn't have been forced, and we were forced into it. I don't think it was done, you know, very ambitiously at the time. You know, obviously it's good buy-in by the RFU now, but, like, it makes everyone try and be better. Like, they're the standard bearers, and as much as sometimes you're like, oh, you know, not going to be much of a game when England are playing someone, you know, that's, you have to break those barriers and push on, and they do that. So I say credit to them for doing that. It's just a pity the rest of the countries didn't try and catch up earlier and you know, be creative. But look, we are where we are now. So what, you just try and, like, try and frustrate them. Like, I, you know, they are the big power in the game. Come in there, just be an absolute nuisance wherever you can. You know, someone like Beavan Parsons, I could be wrong now, but I don't think she's ever played England in a Six Nations game. You know, and she's been around a long time.
I know Eve Higgins certainly hasn't played England before.
Yeah, I think Eve is right.
She mentioned that yesterday as well. So I'm sure that.
Yeah, because they would have. I know Eve is only kind of, I suppose, or was 2021. She would have came in, and Beavan Parsons been around a while, but she would have, her first year didn't play England because of her leave insert and then other duties and stuff. So I don't think they'll challenge themselves off the best girls in the world. And, like, we have some, you know, really good players that should try and, you know, have a cut at England. And that's what your mentality should be, and be excited about it. Like, you know, be really excited about what can we do and see where you're at against the best team in the world. So it should be exciting for them.
I'm not sure, do I finish off this conversation by asking you for a prediction? It feels like we both know what way the result is probably going to go, but I suppose a more nuanced way of asking it would be, what do you think we will see from Ireland this weekend that they can take out and bring to that game against Scotland in the last round? Which, like, ultimately that game against Scotland is going to probably define what we think of this Six Nations Championship. It's not going to be what happens this weekend against England.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we saw against France, we played a lot of territory, and I think Dan O'Brien had a great, I just should mention her, she had a great game against Wales, and she kicked really well, and I think they'll look to play a territory game. But then the flip side of that is England have such good back three and good players to be able to play that. But I think they will try and implement that and, you know, play in the right part of the pitch. Against Wales, their breakdown work was a lot better. They'd pick up ball, and that's when we saw, you know, a lot of their attack coming from, a lot of their scores. So I think, you know, success for Ireland is scoring two tries. If we look at Wales, I think it was 48-10 the score was. And if we beaten Wales 36-0, we should be trying to look for tries. That is success if we can score against them, because not many teams score against, you know, England. Let's be realistic. And if we can get in, and as Scott Beaman has said, you know, fire some shots and be successful in there, that's success. But also trying to limit their, you know, their attack. And we did that very well in 2021, 25-0, but we didn't see any attack. So if we can put the two of them together, you know, limit our England's attack and us be defensively sound and actually fire some shots when we won't have too many opportunities, but the opportunities we have, try and take them as best we can, because it's an interesting one to approach, because you've got, and I would be interested to see how they do approach it. I'm not exactly entirely sure, because you're going against England, the best team in the world. You've got to be realistic, but the next game is the really important one. So, and, you know, they're playing a very different team. So it'd be interesting what way they approach. But I think, you know, territory game, playing the right play, really defensively sound, and trying to fire those shots when you have those opportunities, because there won't be too many of them.
All right. Well, we'll see how it goes this Saturday. Ireland against England kicks off 2:15 p.m. at Twickenham. Live updates and commentary on RT Radio 1 Saturday Sport. And we'll have a live blog on the rt.ie/sport as well, on the RT News app. Alison, thanks so much for joining us this week on the RT Rugby Podcast.
No problem at all. Nice to hear.
We'll speak to you all very, very soon.